I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Kevin Middleton. I'm here with Samantha Berg. And tonight we're going to interview Neelam. She's a spiritual teacher based in New Mexico. And Neelam has a very powerful and wonderful spiritual teaching. And it comes straight from India in the Advaita tradition, or known as non-dual. And she has her own beautiful way of teaching the simplicity of awakening to a deep, unified awareness, the ground of our very own presence. And she teaches that directly experiencing presence in your life is freedom. And by habit, we rely upon our minds for problem solving and insight. But another source of support is often unrecognized and untapped, and that is presence. And Neelam has a wonderful and lighthearted teaching to help people of all faiths and spiritual backgrounds experience the beauty and power of noticing presence. Awakening to this will enrich your life, and it increases our skillfulness in relationship with others and the world.
So I want to introduce everyone to Neelam. Neelam's a native of Poland, and she's been giving satsang, which is meeting in truth, internationally since 1996. She is a direct disciple of one of the 20th century's great masters of Advaita, which is non-duality, H.W.L. Punja, otherwise known as Papaji, who himself awakened to the truth in the presence of Sri Ramana Maharshi. She shares satsang with H.W.L. Punja's blessing. Known for her simplicity, skillful discrimination, and intuitive insight, Neelam gently points us towards the truth at the core of us all. With her extensive personal and teaching experience, she uses inquiry to facilitate us in identifying and moving through deep-seated patterns of conditioning, bringing us to rest and presence. So, and you can learn more about Neelam at www.neelam.org. That's N-E-E-L-A-M.org. Welcome to the show, Neelam. Great to have you here.
Well, yes, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thanks, Neelam. So maybe we could start just if you could give a little bit of background on your own spiritual journey, maybe your early years as a seeker, your background growing up in Poland, and how you came to look for spiritual liberation in India.
No, that's, of course, it's a long story, so I go into all the details of it. But I would say, what's interesting about it is for a long time I didn't really know that I was seeking. That's probably true for many people, you know, that we don't know, but there's just something that moves us in a certain direction. And even though I had early experiences as a child that were experiences of non-duality, that were experiences of the mind dropping and just stillness and really powerful experiences, but they were not recognized for what they were. There was no context in where I was growing up. You know, Poland is very Catholic, and that just was the only spiritual context there. So there really wasn't any, you know, there really wasn't any recognition of that until later when I started to study Tai Chi. I was very, very drawn to this Chinese master who was not alive anymore, and saw him on a video. And that's when I realized that he knows something that I don't know what it is, no, but it's something that I'm really interested in, and I would like to know that. And it was at that time in my life that this, you know, past memory of practices, previous incarnations, started to bleed through a little bit, and this longing for something started more visible, even though it wasn't yet. I really couldn't say, well, I'm seeking, you see, or I'm looking. And then later, out of this volition, that was a volition for really finding, you know, really finding truth, as I know now, right? Out of that volition, I met somebody who was speaking about Mother Mira and became a disciple of her for a couple of years, and I ended up in these very, very extended, blissful states, and I would sit in bliss for hours and hours and hours on end in meditation. However, when I would get up out of my meditations, which lasted really, really long time, I would experience tremendous suffering. So, and I remember one moment, one point then when this happening, which I was lying down and really, like, this is the end, you know, I can't really go on like that. This is such a huge dichotomy, you know, between the blissful states, powerful blissful states, and then extreme suffering. And I remember the thought arising in my consciousness, you know, the thought that said, I want to find someone who can show me what is beyond that.
So that was how you eventually got to HWL Punja, or were there several other teachers in between?
No, this was you know, almost immediately, a couple of weeks later, where I was living, this flyer arrived in a house about satsang, and there was satsang with Gangaji. I never heard about this word satsang nor anything about it, you know, in that way. And I read about her and I thought, wow, she's a Western woman, and as you know, she has obviously awakened, and she obviously is sharing this teaching, and she obviously didn't spend all her life living in some monastery somewhere, you know. So I thought, wow, this is great. And so I went to her meeting, travel back then, and she used for like a month at the time, and I went to her meeting, and that love that I experienced there was so powerful that I remember staying away for the next few days, you know. It was just too much, just felt like too much. And finally, I decided to go back, and the moment back, there was this very powerful experience of the mind just dropping and endless, you know, just resting in its source, and just, you know, it's blissful, but in a very different way, in a way of finally realizing that there's something here, you know, there is something here that is different, that is what all want, that is what we desire. And, you know, I'm not going to go into all the story there, but when in her satsang, she always had up there. So it was somewhere only maybe midway through this meeting that I suddenly recognized Papaji. I suddenly saw him, and I realized, this is my teacher. This is where I have to go, and this is how I ended up going to India.
And there was something different about the kind of higher states you were experiencing with Gangaji than what you had previously experienced, where there was the ecstatic bliss and then the falling away of suffering. What was it that was different in her company?
You mean in Gangaji's company?
Yeah, that had you compelled to follow through to her teacher.
And Punja. We should also clarify for people who are listening that Gangaji is a student of HWL Punja, so she was transmitting Punja's teachings as well. Go ahead, Neelam.
In the past, in these blissful states, when I would stop sitting in meditation, the suffering would come back, right? And so the difference here was that really, you know, something dropped from that identification with the mind. And there really wasn't that reference point that was referencing the mind. And because of that, that state, that blissful state, not limited to meditation, right? That blissful state suddenly revealed that inherent or it that has always been here, right? That has never been anywhere else, and it doesn't really require practice. It just required us to simply bring our attention to it, right? And just simply be here, you know? It didn't matter if I was lying down or sitting or going or waking up or falling asleep, it didn't match it, right? Because that, our true inherent nature just revealed itself, right? And there was the resting in that.
So I have a question about that, because we teach meditation classes, and a lot of people, if they've never meditated before, they feel like the goal is that they're supposed to stop their mind or somehow quiet their mind. And what I'm wondering for you, that initial experience of the mind dropping out, was it truly that the mind stopped, or was it that your attention was on presence? You know, what could you say, looking back on it, what that actually was? Did you have the experience of not hearing the mind, or was it that it was just such a small part of consciousness that it wasn't part of your experience at that moment?
But the truth is that the mind really stopped, right? But see, the stopping of the mind wasn't caused by anything. The stopping of the mind was not a result of any effort. Right? When we are sitting in a practice, even though in a funny way, I encourage now my students to sit, to take time to quiet, right? But when we are sitting in a meditation practice and we have a goal in our mind, when you have a goal, when you meditate and you think, well, this is what I want to reach, this is where I want to go, that very goal, that very effort limits your ability to just simply be here, right? So even though the mind really dropped, the mind really stopped, but it wasn't because of an effort, you see. It wasn't because of anything anybody was doing, right? It was the power of the recognition of truth that stopped the mind, which is really very different than the normal usual effort that we try to make, right, in order to reach some place, yeah?
Yes, and that really was coming from the strength and the power of the teacher that you were with, is that right? Was that something that was coming through in her presence that then you recognized in yourself?
Obviously, there was that power of the recognition, and that recognition just simply vibrates that in everybody, right? Or it simply reveals that in everybody who comes in contact with that, yes.
And then what was the difference when you actually did go to India? And how was that to meet Punja? What was it like? He's an incredible figure, and
Well, the recognition of him as my teacher that happened while I was sitting there in the sat, and then later, you know, all sorts of questions and unfulfilled desires began to arise in my consciousness, and they began to voice the need to maybe not to go to India, to maybe other things in life, that maybe there are some other things that are really important. Papaji coming in a dream and saying to me, cut through the dream, right? And so I remember, you know, 6 months later, I'm arriving in India, and this incredibly, you know, moving and powerful Papaji, who really is the embodiment, you know, this is the living truth, you know, and that's obvious, and that's apparent, and that's powerful, and that's amazing. So I'm in that initial, you know, awe of that. However, you know, there I find myself sitting in satsang. This is so amazing because, you know, the satsang looks so very different than in the West, much more simple, and everything is much more, you know, quiet in a way, and there I am sitting, and what I'm not realizing for the first month or so, that I'm sitting there with my arms crossed, you know, at front of my chest, you know, that kind of image, and waiting for something, right? I'm sitting there saying to myself somewhere, and I can hear it, I'm saying, okay, I'm here. I have had all these amazing experiences. I have seen all these amazing things. You know, there are people that are saying, oh, you don't even need to go to India. You know, it's just amazing to even sit next to you. It's so blissful. It's so, you know, and here I am sitting and waiting, and I'm saying, what do you have to give me? What are you going to show me now, right? And so, you know, and nothing happens, of course, because, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, well, this is kind of, you know, so the attitude waiting, right? So I remember, you know, first of all, realizing very quickly that whatever I have spent, you know, on time to stay there, that's totally irrelevant, that I just really have to stay there as long as it takes, right? Not just whatever I have spent, right? One thing. But then I also get to get guided, as we always do. You see, consciousness works in amazing ways, and it always takes care when that true desire for freedom is here. Always takes care. So I get guided, invited to other people's satsang and to conversations with other students, where I, Papaji students, where I realize, you know, I really have to give myself to it. I really have to devote myself to my teacher. I really have to forget about all the things that I am thinking and I know or whatever, you know. And I write him a letter and I say, I have come here and I feel like my, you know, my one leg is in the ocean and my other is on the shore, you know. And he says, well, you came here to know who you are, you know. Right now you're just like this beautiful bubble that is just like shining, you know, but you, that's not what you, and it, enjoying its own shine, but that's not why you are here, he said. You are here to know your true nature. So I remember from that time on, change within, on, you know, I'm just going to let myself fully be here. I'm just going to devote myself to it. I'm just going to give myself, I'm just going to simply allow whatever really arises in my heart to move forth and simply act on that and not pay attention to what ifs and the mind and the thinking and the, you know, worries and concerns. And so that's from then on, as I'm sitting there with Papaji, that's really what happens. Whenever a desire arises to speak to him or to write to him or to sing or to do this or to do that, you know, I just let it. I just say, okay, that's what is, you see, that's what is needed right now.
So it sounds like you stopped trying to control your experience and you just allowed whatever was there to be there?
Yeah, and also, see, because it's so unconscious oftentimes that we hold back, right? So we don't even realize that. So it was so revealing to actually, you know, hear that from somebody else, you know, and hear that, oh yeah, that's really not the way. The way is to simply give yourself to it, right? To give yourself to whatever arises in a moment.
Do you think that's a Western construct? I wonder if it's different in India, but that ability to just give oneself over to the teaching of the guru, it's just so not...
Part of Western culture.
Yeah, it's not part of what it means to be a Westerner to actually bow down in front of someone else and say, there's someone else that knows better than me, you know, what's good for me.
Submission to the guru.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think about that? Do you think it was more challenging as a Westerner, or do you think that's part of the culture?
Well, you know, culturally, they have it easier for sure. And Papaji of spoke that he can't even talk fully about devotion with Western students because it just gets misunderstood. You see, we have so many concepts about what's not right and what's, you know, submissive and what's this and what's that. But, you know, ultimately, even though maybe his Indian students had an easier time to be on the path of devotion, I ultimately really think it's just the quality of the ego, you know? It's just the quality of the sense of separateness, right? It just simply is, you know, has to assert its sense of separateness, you know, whatever it is, right? So even in subtle ways, you know, even when we have a lot of spiritual experiences like I had before, so that place that just believes itself to be separate, right? Special, unique, somehow different, somehow important, you know? I think really more the ego quality than anything else, even though for sure they have it easier in their culture, for sure.
And is the submission, I mean, the devotion to the guru, Is that the man, or is that the spiritual power coming from the man Punja? Or, you know, is it devotion really to spirit, to consciousness, to God, ultimately?
The devotion is really to the movement that arises within. And if that movement translates to be devoted person at the time, because nothing lasts forever, you see, these are all just tools that consciousness has to bring itself to know its true nature, right? So if that movement really means, that movement means to devote yourself to the person, then that's what it is, you see. If that movement is just a movement towards, you know, if we experience it as a movement towards consciousness or presence, then that's what it is. But I think, especially initially, it's hard to tell, right? Hard to tell what is what, right? Because the movement is just there, you see. And that was very obvious for a period of time. Papaji as a person, not just Papaji as the embodiment of truth, right? There was both for a time. But see, it doesn't matter, because that if the teacher is pure and clear, then that's its function. That's the function of that space that is called teacher, right? To receive that movement, to really receive it with no, you know, interference with that, so that we can fulfill something, you know, that we can come to some fulfillment, some end, right, with that.
Right. And so it sounds like you removed the obstacles to spontaneity, to be available to the opportunity that was opening up in the moment through Punja and through your own deep aspiration.
Exactly. And so then it doesn't matter. Then it's just the movement. If the movement is here, can I follow that, right? Can I be available for that, right?
So what happened next?
I remember really following that and really so strongly hearing the mind and the conditioning that says, no, you can't do that, that's not okay, you know, but really, really following that. And I remember sitting, asking Papaji in a letter, asking, can I come and sit satsang today? Can I just sit at your feet? And he reads the letter and he says, okay, come and sit here. And so I sit there, you know, with my eyes closed. And really, just on the inner, I'm hearing him, and I'm hearing how he speaks to everybody, and I am recognizing within everything that he says is true. Everything that he's speaking is just totally pure. It's just coming just from pure presence, you know. There's just nothing in it. And that recognition in a moment, that level of trust, because we so often think or believe we trust somebody, a teacher or a person, or it doesn't matter in what context, but we can think that, but the actual trust, you know, it happens, right, whenever it happens. And so in that moment, there's that real, something changes deeply within. What changes is that there's no more question about, or there's no more, you know, there's just trust, right? There's no more question about, right, or is this not, or is this, or is this that, right? And the moment that trust, you know, happens, the moment there is that change on the inner, in which there is no more question, like, you know, about it, right? The moment the trust happens, then I remember walking out of that satsang, and the next thing I know, there's a tremendous fear of death that arises. And everything in my body and mind is bracing against that, because that's our habit, right? These are millions of years of believing I'm this body, you know, this body is limited, this body is going to die, that's who I am. And so death means the end, right? There's no more after that. So this really powerful fear of death arises, and there's the bracing against it. And I remember choosing to go with a friend for dinner and choosing to do certain things and really fighting almost internally with that very powerful fear of death that arises. Really not really able or yet tender. And so I remember walking out after the dinner on street, you know, I don't know if you guys have been in India, but very busy, lots and lots and lots and going on. I'm walking on the side, you know, on the street there, and three Indian girls come up to me, and each of them is holding a flower in their hand. And they silently, one by one, they just give me the flower.
Wow.
Wow. I have a question about what you were talking about with trust, and then also about the, what you were saying about the this intense fear of death. What I was wondering is, from when you were sitting at Papaji's feet and you were experiencing that trust, would you say that is really, that level of trust comes from when you recognize that, you know, consciousness is one? You know, that there's no separation, so why would, it's almost like that trust is sort of built in because it's all the same, so there isn't anything, like when you're coming from ego and you're coming from separation, it seems like there's always
there's
a question of whether
protect.
Or not. Yeah, there's something to protect, there's not necessarily, trust has to be earned, but when you're coming from the same place, when, you know, your consciousness and the guru is consciousness, why wouldn't there be trust? It's sort of not a question. And then I'm also wondering about that experience of that fear of death. I mean, what it seems to me is it was, you know, the fear of ego death. The dissolution of the ego. So if you could speak to this,
well, would be great. Well, this, you know, this story continues, and I am going to continue it in a moment, but really, to your question, no, this is not yet the recognition of oneness. This is really a recognition that, you know, the chair serves us in a way where we are gaining trust, gain trust on our own within, right? So this isn't yet the recognition of oneness, you see. This isn't yet that, but this is just the recognition that everything he has been saying, which is, you know, that everything that he is, that everything what he really says is true, right? And so in that recognition, that there's not yet a full recognition of oneness, but there's just the letting go of that holding, of separation, like, well, you know, I know, you know, and I know, and we recognize, no, we don't, right? Or we recognize that whatever we knew wasn't what was true, really, right? So in that moment, we are recognizing, wow, you know, wow, everything that he says, this is the end of that sense of, you know, fighting for our own little corner in consciousness, in universe. So shall we continue with the story? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that's great.
We have a couple more minutes before we're going to take a break, so, yeah.
You know,
or one more minute.
Three little flowers in my hand, that really breaks my heart and opens my heart, and I realize all I need to do is just sit with that fear, right? So I really rush quickly to where I was living, and I just sit down, and there's that really powerful fear of death that just moves through the body, and there's the desire to run to see my teacher, you know, to be at his feet, and then I'm sitting there with my eyes open, the room disappears, everything, you know, that I can see still with my eyes disappears, and the body disappears also.
Wow. Well, Neelam, we're going to take a brief break. You're listening to Neelam, spiritual teacher of non-duality. She's based in New Mexico. We're going to come back in just a few moments, and we'll take a look at her teaching work currently and ways you can get in touch with her. We'll be right back.
KVRF Sutton and K208BC Palmer, broadcasting on 89.5 FM, Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere, and tonight we're interviewing Neelam, spiritual teacher, and we were just getting a story about Neelam's experience with her teacher, Papaji, or otherwise known as H.W.L. Punja. And so, Neelam, if you want to go ahead and continue with the story. What happened after you received the three flowers and your heart started to open up?
Then I just rushed into where I was living, and I just sit down there, really, really say, oh, okay, let's have that. And, you know, that rush of fear, and this fear of death, and desire to be with my teacher and be at his feet, and then sitting there, seeing with my eyes the room disappear, and the walls disappear, and the body disappear.
It was a pure awareness or direct experience of the totality?
It's just, it's really nothing I can say about it, you know, that is so beyond anything that I can say, right? And there's just nothing, you know, there's just absolutely nothing. Absolute deep rest in our true nature.
And did that do something about your understanding? Did that change your understanding in a fundamental way about yourself, like a self-knowledge?
Oh, it's so hard because it really needs some right now. I know it's kind of hard to have silence on the radio, but, you know, because that record, oh, you know, true for everything, for everybody, right?
That was a little bit of silence. That was good.
You know, and you can actually feel into that beautiful open space, and it's a great invitation to the mystery, isn't it?
Only coming back from that really there is coming back to the body, and then there's the bliss in the body, because we need the body to have bliss, right? And then there's, you know, just that recognition for hours and hours and hours, and then finally, the following day, just write down and writing a letter to Papaji and Captain Satsang, then this is where recognition becomes more apparent, with walking into the Satsang hall, recognizing there is no separation. Everything is rising here. Everything is present. Papaji is that. Papaji is arising here. Everything is part of that.
So how much longer did you stay with Papaji before you ended up going out on your own as a teacher? How did that process go?
I didn't hear that.
Oh, sorry. I was saying, so how much longer after that did you stay with Papaji? And when did you eventually go out on your own as a teacher?
I don't remember how long, maybe another month time. Then I remember coming back to the States and just inadvertently sharing this expansion with everybody that I was in contact with, and many people were really touched and interested, and eventually sitting satsang, and eventually corresponding with Papaji, eventually blessing for me. That happened very quick, you know. That happened maybe in the next several months after that.
You know, there's some, you know, a lot of people have spiritual experiences, and I get a sense of a progression of a deepening understanding along the way, and the purity of the transmission of truth through Punja, and then how that was connecting with your deep, authentic aspiration and sincere, really, ego dissolution, and making you really ripe for this kind of powerful realization. And I'm wondering, was there any fear that it wouldn't last? Was there something different about this experience that was beyond experience? In one way, it was clearly an experience, but it's something can't be spoken about. And yet, I'm just wondering if you can give any of us a sense of the distinction there. What was so different about this,
hard to describe, because no, there was no fear about it not last. Oh, there wasn't a concern whatsoever, right? Coming back from that, there was knowing that everything where it is, they're all taking a problem. And so there wasn't really a concern about anything. There was just moment a little concerned with body because burning so much energy through the body just caused a little challenges, you know, physical challenges, but that passed also. So, you know, the difference between that, you know, first of all, we all have experiences, right? Experiences are just expanded consciousness, right? And when the mind drops, and even if there is that falling into our true nature, that is still not the final, right? Because there is still somebody that, or somebody experienced that, right? But eventually, what happened in this moment, in that moment of that awakening, or that, you know, whatever we call it, right? Happened is that body there anymore watching it, right? Coming out of there, there wasn't anything more to see or to observe, right? That point of reference that we have, you know, where we refer to ourselves unconsciously as this body, mind or ego, you know, where we even physically point and we say me, that's me, right? Over here, point to the body. And that point of reference just shifted, you know, it shifted in our true nature. And so when that shifts, you know, and it doesn't mean, I want to clarify, it doesn't mean that no conditioning ever arises again. That's I want to make clear, because another misunderstanding. But there is no more that refers oneself as something, right? And that's not mental that there is no more. This is an actual experience. There isn't any more there and me and them and this and something else, right? This is, and there isn't anybody looking at it or watching it anymore.
Was there a period of time of integration into your relative life for you to function in the world?
Oh, that has a long time, and I would say that is I'm in a different way right now. Back from India, I remember I just mostly needed time quietly sitting. I try to do things, and I try to, you know, get a job and do some things, but that wasn't holding. What it needed was there was no need to talk or do things or engage in any way. There was hours of just being, right? Just simply being. And that process of integration. However, you know, what I know now also that powerful, and that awakening was so powerful that there has been arises, and so there isn't, you know, like we say this an end, you know, this has ended, right? I would say that the real integration is going on, you know, all going on. That is still everything needs to be informed of this. Everything, you know, so that is, I don't know that it ever ends, and maybe it does, but you know, better, right? This is still happening.
Interesting. I've asked a few spiritual teachers this question before, but from what you described, when you said you tried to go back to your life and you tried to get a job and you tried to do normal things, and you found that just wasn't working. So I just wonder, for the average person, you know, what would you say to somebody who is just coming to this conversation for the first time, you know, maybe hasn't done any spiritual seeking before, you know, they've just tuned in. And why would somebody want to wake up to their true nature? What would be the reason for that?
Well, you know, what we don't realize most of the time is what is the cause of, right? So when we are, you know, kind of in the world living out there and not even realizing yet that we are suffering, right? We don't even have these questions, you know. You know the saying, ignorance is bliss, right? Mm-hmm. But the moment we start to begin to realize that we are suffering, the moment this little bubble bursts and we begin to know, like, well, there are good times and bad times, and there's this and there's that, and a more fundamental sense of not really things being really at ease or restful or at peace, you know. And when we begin to see even a little bit that suffering is present, then, you know, the reason why we would want to investigate that was the only way the suffering ends is when we understand what causes that, right? And you see in our society, in our world, in our, you know, just the regular things, you know, we put responsibility on the outside. Say, well, if this was made more money, if we had a better job, house, if our relationship was working, if the, our health was better, or if our this or that, by doing that, we really miss that. So outward oriented or inward in a really kind of judgmental way of what does, why can't we be happy, and all sorts of stuff like that. What causes suffering, right? And if we investigate that, begin to realize that the suffering caused by misidentification, that we are not identifying, that because we are identifying ourselves as something that we are not, because we are believing that this body, this mind, this ego is are, because we are believing that that is what suffering, right? So if we can really know that, if we can really get that, if we can really understand none of these other things, no matter how much they are going to change, that's not going to alleviate that sense of discontent or discomfort, then we can begin to want to look at that, right? Then we can begin to want at that and desire, desire to know what is it really? What is it really like, right? Who are we really? What is really, you know, going on, right?
So a certain point, people may arrive in their lives where they start inquiring. They start looking deeper at their lives, at their situation, at the true source of their suffering, and realizing that a lot of it may be rooted in ideas or way habituated reactions to the way they're living their life. And ultimately, you can't really point to anybody but yourself. And so is it at that point that somebody really becomes ripe to be a student for this kind of teaching? Do they have to come to that place before they can hear what you have to teach them?
Well, we never know. We just never know, really, you know, because when I was coming to it, it didn't seem like I was, the last 2 years before, it seemed like I was really searching. But all this time before, it really didn't look like that, right? So maybe it's like that beginning we are still trying different things, suffering go away. It's really in the moment that we realize that we can't make it go away. No matter what we do, see, take my blissful states in meditation, you know, still suffering. And endless hours of blissful meditation, still suffering, right? Realize that no matter what we do, no matter what we try, that the suffering is not going to go away. Then that's when we are ready, right? Because then we are ready to really investigate it, really see like, whoa, wait a minute, so what's causing it? If I can understand what's causing it, then there's something I can do about it, right?
Absolutely. And how would you lay out, maybe in a general way, the foundation of your teaching work? How can you describe what you do?
It's a little harder to speak very briefly because there's a lot of elements in it, right? Because the first foundation is, you know, that the really, obviously, the reason why people would come and why, what would bring them here to speak with me is because there is a desire within them to know, right? So that is already there, right? Then there is, of course, the level of trust that needs to happen over time. We don't know. With some people it happens very quickly. With some people it happens over time. That's another thing that just happens, right? Then there is the real art that I point, where I point them towards their true nature. I point them towards the very direct experience of who they are, right? That recognition has to be here, because if we don't have that recognition, it doesn't maybe know in that forever way yet, but without that recognition, how can we even speak about it, right? Now, and all these things run, concurrently, so it's not like it's one or the other after the other, they just all happen in different times, right? But when there is that necessity for people to recognize, you know, that their true nature, they have to have the direct experience of that, right? And after that, sense where a person is at, because if they are strong habits that block your ability to be here, recognize your true nature, but you can't really sustain that recognition, then part of my work is helpful to address that. Part of my work really in directing you towards these patterns, in direct towards seeing and understanding what causes your inability to remain here in the present, and ultimately over time your ability to address that, right? So I'm also teaching people tools like inquiry, you know, just self-inquiry, different ways of how to address what arises, how to address what our attention away from our true nature.
And why is it so challenging just to rest in our own true nature? If our ever-present presence is always here, and it's the very ground of our existence, why is it so difficult to rest in that?
Well, you know, past, we have a habit following the past. Have a habit, our what arises. So we do, even though we might have the recognition of our, when past arises, past which usually lies really dormant in our past that is not always visible, it just only is going to come up to the surface when circumstances are right. Certain situations are present and suddenly, you know, everything was fine and quiet. Suddenly, boom, you are in a lot of reaction. Because this was the right time and the right circumstance for that past to be brought in on the surface. And when that happens, the habit is to follow that, right? Habit is, or we can say, you know, we are already engaged with it. Have engaged with past a really long time ago. And so now we have to, first of all, recognize it. We have to say, oh, that's the past. Wait a minute, right? Like, this is not just what's going on and what's happening out there and what's happening with me. This is the past, right?
So if there's a certain charge or intensity, you're in a conversation with your spouse and it's heated and there's a lot of reaction, then what you're saying, that is past is present. I mean, you're bringing, there's a habit, there's a reaction that's not really born of the present moment, that one has taken their attention off of true nature at that point. Is that true?
And past is present, meaning your past, your individual past, her past, or, you know, whoever is speaking with each other and having an argument, your past is present, other person's past is present, the past between you two is present also. What happens in that moment, the movement of the past is always continue in that pattern, right? Mm-hmm. But there is momentum of it because that's how it's itself, right? It can't sustain itself if you are present, right? So we always try to look for resolution aging in the pattern, right? And I'm saying, whoa, wait a minute. First, we need to recognize that that's past, right? Once we recognize it, then we need whatever time is necessary, see? whatever time is necessary to come back to rest in our true nature, right? Remember when I was saying story about death arising, it's like, well, we have to first, you know, let it be here, right? But we have to recognize it for what it is, you know, that's the past, right? And whatever we need to come back to rest in our true nature. So it only once we are able to come back to rest, fully engage in a different way, we are not anymore in that engagement past, right? Now we can come back from the present and act or say something or engage or don't do anything, right? But we have to first really process of it, because otherwise we are just lost in that, right?
So how do you encourage people to do that? What's the actual process of that? If somebody comes to you with something that they're struggling with, how do you direct them to see how much, you know, the past is in the present and being able to separate that and bring them back to presence?
And just as a tag along to that is what I hear, or I think I'm hearing, is that we have to not resist reality, that we have to in some way allow what is to be what it is, because after all, it is. And if what is unacceptable to us, it feels unacceptable to us, that seems like it'll be a pretty big barrier. So maybe just follow up with Sam's question and just keep that one in mind.
So you know, how do I encourage, well, you know, if I see the person, for me to help them to see that, right? However, I'm not always there available with them, so I really teach everybody that comes, and that's a process that takes some time, because there is a certain foundation that I want everybody to have. I want them to really know what experientially, and I want them to really know what past is experientially. And I, you know, so there is a certain process, but eventually I end up teaching everybody a process of inquiry that then they can do on their own, right? Of course, you know, that's what's powerful, that, you know, that, you know, it's always great when we can talk with the teacher and we can do it together, but it's so amazing that we can, and it works on its own, and it works with another student to just sit down and do inquiry, right? And so we can, you know, so ultimately that's how I encourage people, by teaching them, right? And so when they see the result, they go like, wow, that's great, it works, you know? And what you are saying, Kevin, is you have to learn to recognize what is, and so need live in the reality of our experience. So if we live in the future, even if the future is awakening, or even if the future is freedom, you know, or if we live in the past of what happened in the past, or what we would like to happen, which is future, even if that future is about awakening, then we are not present. So we can only live in the reality of what is, and what I really so deeply to recognize is, am I at rest in this moment? Am I at rest, or am I suffering? Because when I'm suffering, there's something I can do about it, you see? But if I'm in the delusion or the illusion that I'm not suffering, right, then there's nothing I can do about it. So, because ultimately what we want, see, what everybody wants, what consciousness wants all the time, right? What we really want is just to be here. So in every moment, even when past is present, and when we are engaged in reactivity, what we really want is just to know our true nature. So I'm saying, okay, in a moment, investigate. Are you at this moment, or are you suffering? Because if you are at rest, then hey, let's enjoy, right? But if you are suffering, there is something that you can do about it. Let's be present, right?
Do you think that your teaching has changed over the years with working with people? Have you seen you know, anything different in terms of how you started with people and how you are with them now? Or do you feel like fundamentally once that message came through and from the time that you spent with Punja, that it's pretty much been the same message the whole way through?
Tremendously. And what has changed, you know, essence has not changed. Neither the essence of my own experience nor the essence of why I'm teaching, right? That has not changed. However, the expression of it has changed tremendously. And in the beginning, really, it was just the overflow of that awakening and that flow of just wanting to share the direct experience with everybody, right? And that also, part of the same words that Papaji would use, these were the words that I have heard for months and months and months, right? That was just natural. But at some point, all of that has fallen away. First of all, I realized that, you know, people come, they have great experience, but then they can't sustain that. They don't know what to do next, right? They have an experience and then passes, and then they just back to normal. So eventually I realized that something more is needed, and that addition to really sharing that direct experience of presence, also a need to really inquire and to really point people addressing their past, because that's what does not being able to resting in the present, right? So the expression has changed, the words have the wording, you know, I speak differently about it than I used to, for sure, when I first started, which was, you know, probably, I don't know, 15 years ago at least or more, you know, when I first started sitting with students. So, of course, all of that has changed, but the essence of it didn't, right? The essence of it remains the same, and that is freedom is available, possible, available in this life, and you know that, right?
Absolutely. Reminds me of a conversation I had with you about 6 years ago, Neelam. It was our first conversation, and I had this direct experience that you're speaking about, and I just laughed hysterically because it was so obvious. And it was like it was just a happy discovery. And the power of that was incredible, because there's a new reference point. And so I really appreciate the absolute simplicity of what you're communicating.
So we have about a minute to go, and I just want to let people know a few things about Neelam. Is that you can actually do a teleconference satsang with Neelam, and there also are programs coming up. So there's a Thursdays starting July 25th through August 22nd, Authentic Living, How Resting in Presence Clarifies Our Expression in the World. It's a 5-week teleconference program. And also Neelam has a 6-month program for newer students that's going to start on October 27th with a Q&A call on Sunday. That's October 13th. And then there's some more events coming up Sunday, July 14th, 11 a.m. Mountain Time, Relationships, The Path to Freedom, How to Use Projection as a Gateway to Presence. It's a 3-hour satsang with Neelam. And you can either contact Neelam's office at Fire of Truth at info@neelam.org. That's info@neelam.org. And you can get more information about Neelam and Fire of Truth, and it can be found on the website, and then again is neelam.org. So is there anything else that you would like to say, Neelam, before we head out?
Really, I just very enjoyed the conversation, and I'm glad we can do it. I hope that was helpful to everybody. And really, I just... want to invite everybody, you know, because in this moment, they're sitting here, who you are, your true nature is here. And we can, in this moment, really, really, just simply bring our that.
Great. That's a great place to end. All right. Thank you very much, everyone. You're listening to Spiritual Teacher Neelam on Bridge to Everywhere. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Neelam.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.